It's Northeast Delta Dental Radio with Tom Raffio.
Welcome to Northeast Delta Dental Radio. I'm Tom Raffio for Northeast Delta Dental Radio, and I'm also the head coach of the dental insurance company known as Northeast Delta Dental. Well, where does the time go? It's already June 5th and 6th, depending on when you're listening to this. We run after the 9 o'clock news, both on Saturday and Sunday, right here on The Pulse. I want to give a big shout-out to my guest last week, Phil Taub, who is coordinating Swim with a Mission, which actually is coming up in July, and it was appropriate giving the talk on veterans that I had Phil on the show during Memorial Day weekend. But this weekend with me is Steve Roberge, who's the extension specialist, and our topic is our New Hampshire forests. And Steve works for the University of New Hampshire Cooperative Extension as the extension forestry specialist, and grew up in northern New Hampshire, Berlin, New Hampshire, surrounded by the White Mountains. So, Steve, thank you for joining me this weekend. I think I'm really well connected, but my producer, Mike Pollan, always is able to find me a guest that who I don't really know that well. So tell us about your background, and has the green thumb in the forest always been part of your life?
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on and taking an interest in New Hampshire's forest. So my background is really in forestry. I grew up, as you said, in Berlin, New Hampshire, and surrounded by the White Mountains, and having a mother and a father who enjoyed hiking and camping, and my parents would actually take me camping every month, regardless of the weather. So being outside was pretty important. My mother was an avid hiker, hiking with her girlfriend throughout the White Mountains, and my father as well. And so, with that background, growing up in the city, but really surrounded by forest. And also knowing other people's parents who worked in the woods, being loggers or foresters, you name it. I kind of wanted to get into being in the woods for a living. And I knew that you could do that. And so when I went to UNH, I started out as a wildlife biologist, but quickly transitioned over to forestry after taking a couple classes, and have really kind of stayed in that lane since 1999. Got a master's in forestry, and then
went to Yale for that. I did. I'm an Ivy League grad. I never realized that Yale had a master's in forest science. How did you pick Yale for that?
Well, Yale is a pretty good name to have on your resume.
Well, that's true.
But Yale though is the oldest forestry school in the United States, and so the professors, the advisors that you would be working with are also the same people who wrote the textbooks. So that's one of the reasons why I went there.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, it's just a great wealth of knowledge to work with those folks. Yeah.
So I know you also serve currently on the New Hampshire Forester Licensing Board and founding member of something called the Glass Museum. But so how did you then, how did you get your current position?
Yeah. So since 2006 to about March 2020 last year, I worked as an extension forester in the county. So in New Hampshire, we have county foresters who work for Cooperative Extension, who meet with private landowners, folks who just own forest land, free of charge, provide them education about their land, and identify opportunities and resources that they can use. So since 2006, I was doing that, and there was a retirement, and then that position that I'm currently in opened up, and I slid into that. And I currently oversee the county forester program with a number of other training programs and educational opportunities for landowners and natural resource professionals.
Great. And the website for the University of New Hampshire Cooperative Extension is extension.unh.edu. So on the sort of practice of forestry, which we know is way more, of course, than just cutting down trees. So if someone's listening to this, and if I run into my neighbor who's interested, do you literally come to people's homes and educate them on let's say they happen to have a few hundred acres of forest? Do you help educate them, or how does that whole thing work?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the bulk of what the Extension Forestry Program does is work with private landowners, and that's about, depending upon how you measure it, that's about three quarters of New Hampshire's forest is owned just by regular folks like you and I. And the county foresters, you know, you give them a call, tell them your situation, and, you know, they'll arrange a visit, and we'll spend as long as you like out walking your woods, you know, a couple hours, whole day type of thing, and depending upon the size of the property. And, yeah, we'll take a look, do an assessment, figure out what you have out there, if there's any opportunities that you're interested in. The biggest thing is kind of sorting out landowners' goals, or kind of what the landowner wants their forest to look like, or what they want to get their what they want to get out of their forest in the future, and whether that's, you know, hiking trails, or, you know, generating some revenue for the kids to go off to college, or just, you know, doing a conservation easement where they can protect the land. You know, we can have that conversation, provide them the information they need, and hopefully they can make a good decision in the future based on that information. But yeah, we absolutely meet with landowners on a daily basis. You know, depending upon the year, 1,000 to 1,500 landowners a year are visited by our county foresters in the state. And that's the bulk of what we do. We also provide educational opportunities either through workshops or online seminars, provide, you know, fact sheets, you name it, to those folks too. So we're considered a resource for those forest landowners.
Well, so help me out. So if I'm in the Concord area, for example, and I'm interested in, I have a lot of land, and I'm interested in, you know, either maybe getting into conservation, or as you say, you know, make money. I mean, what website do I contact, or who do I contact for the? Because I'm assuming, you know, that there's a whole team of foresters that are, you know, qualified. So obviously, one person can't handle the whole state. So what's the access point?
Yeah, so the access point is our quick website is nhwoods.org, and that will kick you over to the Forestry Extension webpage, that way you can kind of sort out where you are in the state, figure out which county forester is appropriate for you.
Great.
So, you know, and Concord would be the Merrimack County Forester, Tim Fleury, and he would, you know, you give him a call, and he would come out and take a look at your woodlot.
Wow. So what's that website again, New Hampshire Wood?
Sure. What? Yeah, NH as in New Hampshire, Woods, Woods, .org. So nhwoods.org.
Super. This has been really, really interesting. Now, in your home life, you also, I guess, tend to a lot of maples that you tap. So let's segue briefly into that and tell us how you got into that and what that process is, because obviously this is the spring, so we must be right in the middle of it.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're the maple season's all done, but
no.
we still washing some equipment here and there from the season. But yeah, so we at home tap anywhere from 300 to 700 taps or trees to get some sap out of that. I got into that, or came exposed to it as an early age, again, growing up in Berlin. There's a fantastic sugar house in Berlin called Deesone's Sugar House, way up on top of a hill in the city. And, you know, that sugar house was always open to us for school group tours and things like that. So I remember being a kid and going there and just being amazed with that process. If you've ever been in a sugar house, it's definitely worth checking out in open houses and going in, seeing how it's done. But, you know, it's just a really neat opportunity to be exposed to that. And, you know, as I got further in my career, I actually became the state's maple specialist for extension, you know, working with the producers and working with trees, the maple trees. And it kind of slowly crept into my personal life as well. And so I'm actually looking out of my home office right now into some of the sugar maples I tap. And so it's a very close thing for me to do. And I've been doing, at least personally, for about five or seven years. I can't remember.
Wow.
How it's been going on. Yep.
And you're also a judge, and you travel like to Pennsylvania. So it's a good thing you're a runner, and we will talk about that, because apparently you consume like close to 7,000 calories of syrup over 10 hours. So how do you not like wheel yourself out of there?
I don't know how. That was a funny thing. That, yeah, we were doing some maple judging in Pennsylvania, and we did the calculations at the end of the day. You know, we weren't feeling great to begin with, just because you're drinking syrup all day. It's not like tasting wine where you spit it back out. You just consume it, you know. And yeah, the calculation was about 6,600 calories of maple syrup in that one day. We didn't know how to fix that. So I think a beer was necessary after that. I don't think that made that any better. But the judging is a really fun part of my job, actually, is you get to taste some really great syrups. But when you become a maple judge, it's usually the bad syrups that people give you. And so they say, you know, what's wrong with this syrup? And there's a whole bunch of things that can go wrong with it. And so, unfortunately, I taste some really horrible syrups as well in this process.
Oh, geez. Now, part of the way you keep those calories off is through your road racing and trail racing. And, of course, you know, I was actually did a trail race at Mines Falls recently. It was really cool. And, of course, racing, thanks to Millennium Running, actually has returned. It's returned, actually, in June of 2020, and with, you know, stage starts and so forth. So tell us a little bit about your cross-country career.
Sure, yeah. I started running track, actually, in middle school in seventh grade. And I ran track through for 6 years, and I did cross-country through 4 years through high school. And that was a great experience to get kind of exposed to it, and I was able to kind of keep in shape for, you know, in between those seasons, just skiing, cross-country skiing and downhill skiing as well, you know, up in Berlin. And that was a great, great experience. And, you know, it's funny when, Delta Dental came up, and it just kind of flashbacks of all the t-shirts that you get from road races. And there's always the Delta Dental kind of sponsorship.
Yeah, we're usually on there, and I see that I've done the Mount Washington, the Northeast Delta Dental Mount Washington road race nine times. And this year coming up over Father's Day weekend will be my 10th, so maybe I'll see you there. It is on this year. We're doing the women on Saturday and the men on Sunday for socially distanced reasons, so I'm glad you've done that. And of course the Thunder Chicken race is a famous race in New Hampshire too, so we have that in common. So after commercial break, I really want to get now into the statistics, and some of these I think will really surprise people in terms of how much of the state is covered by forest land and how much is owned by private landowners. So we'll get into that with Steve Roberge, who's an extension specialist, and Steve works for the University of New Hampshire Cooperative Extension as an extension forestry specialist, lives in Peterborough, and if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about the Glass Museum as well. Welcome back to Northeast Delta Dental Radio. Tom Raffio, and this weekend with me, June 5th and 6th, hard to believe we're already in June, is Steve Roberge, who is an extension specialist. And Steve works for the University of New Hampshire Cooperative Extension as the extension forestry specialist. And really interesting life he leads in terms of both maple syrup, but also what a forester does. And you know, it is really his responsibility to educate forest land owners about the important role of stewards of the forest. So let's start there, with some statistics such as how much of the state is currently covered by forest and how much of the forest land is owned by private landowners.
Sure, yeah. New Hampshire, in general, is a pretty small state. You know, we're about 5 million acres total, if you count water and urban areas and things like that, but about 82% of that is covered with forest land, and that's about 4.7 million acres. If you're thinking about California and things like that, I think 4.7 million acres is what burned last year in the wildfires, which is quite a large number. But that's what we're dealing with here in New Hampshire as a small state. So small state, but we are mainly covered with forest land. We're actually the second most forested state in the nation, right behind Maine. Because of that, New Hampshire's forest plays a pretty big role, in our landscape, our way of life, our wildlife, our clean water. And so that's why there's a bunch of folks like myself out there, motivating landowners and making sure they care for their forest land.
And interestingly enough, and I actually learned this in preparing for this show, but also when I did Leadership New Hampshire, in the 1800s, this wasn't always the case, where maybe less than half of the state was forested. So how did this all transform from less than 50% to almost 90%?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do. It's all about farming. Like as you said, in the 1800s, most of it was sheep farming. That was the vast majority of our landscape was used for farming sheep and later cattle. But when the Erie Canal opened up and there was that westward expansion, folks realized that there was no rocks in the soil in Ohio and the Midwest, and they gave up farming here, and they actually migrated to, you know, to those states. And it was that migration that led to this huge drop in population and people just abandoning land. These pastures that were once available for sheep were just left to grow up. And if you stop mowing your lawn for a year or two, you realize that trees start to grow. And that's what we did. That's what happened really towards the later half of the 1800s. It was that abandonment of farmland and then our forests kind of coming back. So I usually tell folks, if you see a stone wall in the middle of the woods, chances are both sides of those walls or that wall was cleared for pasture and farmland. So even though it's in the middle of the woods, at one point it was cleared for agriculture.
Oh, that's good to know, because I actually have one of those in my backyard. I was wondering that. I learn something every day. This is great. Now, of course, even though over 80% of our state is covered by forest land, are we losing forest land to conversion, though?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the, that's what keeps me up at night, I guess, is that loss of forest land over time. And so I think in the 60s, we kind of hit peak forest again, where all that land grew back up and we had about, close to 90% forest land cover. I think it was like 87% or so. And then since the 60s, there's been just this steady decline of forest loss. And this time it wasn't clearing land for agricultural purposes. It was really just for house lots. And, you know, of course, we all need places to live. You know, I'm situated on a 3-acre lot in the middle of the woods. So I can't say, you know, don't cut down forest to make a house lot. But that's the pressures our forest and everything that we get out of our forest are feeling today, is that conversion pressure. And, as the real estate market heats up and all those things, we do see that loss of forest land. So I think, thinking about smart growth and doing, conserving land for recreational opportunities, conserving land for working forest opportunities, harvesting timber, all that, I think is an important conversation to have in the future, just so that we can kind of maintain all those functions and things that we extract from the forest, so we don't lose them to conversion or just poor planning and development.
And how does, so if you, in one of these conversations, when one of your colleagues is having a conversation with a citizen that owns a lot of land, and that citizen is thinking of, would this be applicable for conservation, how does that conversation go, and what's that process? Does it have to be of a certain size and questions like that?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. And the size of the property is not always the defining characteristic. It's really the where is that property located in the landscape and what functions does that property provide. And so you can have a little 5-acre piece of property that's right up against, say, the Kentucky River, and that's providing some great floodplain habitat or flood storage or flood mitigation properties for that property. And that's going to be a great piece that would be conserved. At the same time, you may have a 500-acre property that is in the middle of a large forest block, provides for a lot of wildlife habitat, provides for watershed filtration, all these things that you get from a large forest, and that has maybe equal value it's still something you'd want to consider conserving. And so when I'm speaking with a landowner about conservation, one is to essentially describe the wide spectrum of conservation options that are out there. It's not just locking land up forever or selling the land. There's a number of different ways that landowners can conserve a property, and that's like that could be a whole kind of 2-hour talk show on that. But it's also kind of figuring out what the landowner wants the property to look like in 40 years or 50 years, or do they want to leave it for their children, and how do you get to that point? And that's usually how I start, is, what do you want the property to look like in the future? And in some cases, they say, I want this to be a forest land forever. And so that, that leads to that conversation about, well, let's think about, how do we get there? Let's think about conservation options for you, or, who's going to keep that land forested for you? And so it's a pretty complex conversation that we have, but, hopefully we can kind of go through that that process while we're out there visiting the landowner or following up with some letters or, you know, another phone call. But it's not just one, you know, one size fits all for folks.
It's definitely a thoughtful conversation. And like you said, like, so I know we work for the Forest Society for the land behind here at Delta Dental, because it is on a floodplain and there is now land in conservation near Morrell Farm. So it's definitely an important process. So on that topic, like, how do you interface, let's say, with the Forest Society organization?
We're great partners with them, and quite often we'll provide. The Forest Society does a lot of great land management on their properties that they own, and so quite often we'll do what we call timber harvest tours. Where when they're doing a timber harvest, we'll go out with when we used to be able to do that, go out 50, 60 people, and just kind of tour that woodlot. While there's an active timber harvest going on, and really kind of outline the thought process that goes on with planning a timber harvest, and kind of point out the benefits and consequences of harvesting timber on certain properties, and answer questions that people may have. And a lot of times people are showing up because they're curious about harvesting timber on their own property, or they're just concerned about the property itself, and they're there to learn about what's going on. And so we'll provide educational opportunities like that with the Forest Society. The great thing about land conservation in New Hampshire is that all these organizations are usually working together for a common good, and that's conserving land. And so a lot of times we'll refer landowners to the Forest Society or other local land trusts, and they may take them in as a project, or they'll pass them along to another land trust that fits the needs of the landowner. So, we work with the Forest Society both with education and working with their staff, but also refer landowners to them too if the landowner is interested in conservation options for their property.
Great, and like you said, I think everybody's collaborative and the missions mm-hmm. are the same. So, two websites for Steve. If you want to reach Steve at University of New Hampshire Cooperative Extension, it's extension.unh.edu. Excuse me. And if you are interested in being educated by a forester, go on nhwoods.org in a local, and you may be able to connect with a forester who can educate you on what your goals are and take it from there. So you are a very eclectic person. So now I'm going to switch gears quickly as we close the show. So tell us about the Glass Museum, which is where you're sort of living now in Peterborough, and tell us about your little passion for antique vehicles, which, of course, are the antithesis necessarily of conservation, but nevertheless, we all have our passions. So give us 1 minute on each.
Oh, sure, yeah. So the Glass Museum is a local nonprofit in Peterborough that puts on the annual arts and music festival called the Sing in the Spring, and it's a kind of Wednesday to Sunday event that normally would happen at the beginning of June. A lot of the concerts would be free to the public or very low cost, so very accessible to folks, and located in downtown Peterborough. And, it's been going on for, I think, about 12 years now or so. And, in the past 6 years or so, we've formed a nonprofit to kind of, get us into that different level of, getting sponsorships and things like that. But it's been a great event, and
contact Delta Dental about that, because it's maybe the one not-for-profit maybe we haven't donated to. And lastly, so you inherited a 69 Volkswagen from your dad, and that's put you into a habit of antique vehicles. So that must keep you busy as well on weekends.
Yeah, exactly. It keeps me busy. Yeah, I inherited the passion for old cars, which is more of a disease, I guess. But definitely the 69 Volkswagen is the kind of the highlight of the collection and what I work with. But it definitely keeps me busy, because if you've ever dealt with old cars, there's always something wrong with them.
Absolutely, and I'm assuming on the Volkswagen camper, you probably have a peace sign on the back or something like that.
Oh, so. I keep it discreet, I guess. It's all
there. You go. So, but the major topic today. So, if you want to reach Steve at the Cooperative Extension, it's extension.unh.edu, and if you want to get in touch with a forester, contact nhwoods.org. So I've learned a lot today about you as well as foresting. So thank you very much, Steve, for spending time with me this weekend, and perhaps see you at the Northeast Delta Dental Mount Washington Road Race upcoming on Father's Day weekend.
Oh, excellent, Tom. Thanks. I really appreciate it.